three arguments today. There'll be a 10-minute break in between each argument. We ask that if you need to leave during the arguments that you please do so quietly. Just a friendly reminder before we begin to please turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices, especially if you're on the case. The sessions are being recorded and broadcast live over the internet, courtesy of St. Mary's University. There will be, there is a brochure available just outside the front doors with biographical information about each of the justices and information about the cases that you'll hear today. The court will be out shortly. Thank you. All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 090399, BP America Production Company, Atlantic Richfield Company, and Vastar Resources, Inc. versus Stanley G. Marshall and others from Zapata County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 090794, LTTS Charter School, Inc., doing business as Universal Academy, versus C2 Construction, Inc., from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And 090955, Allen Keller Company, versus Barbara Jean Foreman and others from Gillespie County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Guzman is not sitting in the first cause. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument now in the first matter, 090399, BP America versus Marshall.
May it please the court? Mr. Phillips and Ms. Barron will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Phillips will open with the first 7 minutes. Mr. Phillips and Ms. Barron will both present rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court. These two cases being argued together today reveal the difficulties that arise in the law when courts honor stale claims, particularly those from the oil patch. In this case, the Court of Appeals upheld a jury verdict that ARCO, BP America's predecessor, committed fraud by making statements in 1981 that caused the plaintiffs, the Marshalls, to believe that a lease was still in force on their mineral interest underlying a large ranch in Webb and Zapata counties, when in fact that lease had by that time terminated for lack of production. In this court, BP will focus on four errors that the Court of Appeals made in our half of the case. First, we urge that the Marshall's claim against us was time barred as a matter of law. Second, that there was no evidence that any of BP's statements amounted to fraud. Third, that in any event there was no evidence of fraud damages, and fourth, further in the alternative, that the award of a future accounting against BP was clearly erroneous. I will attempt to address as many of these grounds as I can. First, the claim is clearly barred by limitations, having been brought more than 20 years after ARCO made its allegedly fraudulent statements to the marshals back in June of 1981. Under our law, the only way the marshals can defeat this defense of limitations is by showing that they acted with reasonable diligence to discover and protect their rights. Well, what did the marshals know? As of June 1981, they knew that the primary term of their 5-year lease to ARCO had expired the previous July of 1980, and that ARCO could only keep that lease in effect by undertaking continuous operations with no cessation of more than 60 days. The marshals also knew that ARCO had drilled only one well on this lease and was spudded about 2 weeks before the primary term of the lease was to expire. They knew that that well had taken 9 months to complete and rework, whereas the average well out in this area of the state was about 3 months to complete. So what did the marshals do with the primary term of the lease over? We're in overtime, as it were. What did they do to protect their interests and get their mineral interest in this ranch back if indeed their lease had expired? Well, for almost a year, they did nothing. Then on June 25th, one of the marshals called ARCO and had a 3 to 5 minute talk with one of ARCO's representatives, who 4 days later sent a 3-page letter outlining what ARCO had done on the lease, and that's in this bench book at tab 4. That's all they did. Based on the one conversation and reading the one letter, they sat back.
Why isn't that enough? Why must they do something more than rely upon the party whom they're dealing with to tell them the truth? And every statement or all the information that's pertinent for them to make a decision, why must they do more?
Well, first, I'll get to the point in a minute that nothing ARCO said was a lie or incorrect, and it's not a fraud for various reasons. But let's assume it was. Why they must do more is this court's jurisprudence that a claimant who wants to assert a stale claim must exercise reasonable diligence. To exercise a claim, you've got to use reasonable diligence to discover it. For instance, in Heckey Exploration versus Neal, you held that the Neals were put on notice by the fact that there were other operators in the area and by the fact that the reservoir underlying their interest was a common reservoir with other leases. And they were on notice of that so that they were supposed to know that their lease was being drained, even though they weren't geologists and they couldn't go a mile under the surface. And presumably they couldn't even directly get into behind locked gates and look at what the other drillers had done.
So assuming that the actions taken by Mr. Young and ARCO at the time was the fraudulent intent, it's your argument that still, in the face of that, that the marshal was under some duty to conduct a reasonable inquiry?
Yes, and that's what this court unanimously held last year in Curlin versus Salceda. That in the face of Mr. Curlin's repeated flat-out lies to the Salcedas that they didn't have a royalty interest, that the Salcedas were required to go look through the mineral deeds in the county courthouse and discover that indeed they did have a royalty interest and they could not lay back for 30 or 40 years
so
and then bring a suit
owner,
for fraud.
Every royalty owner can no longer, under your reading of Salceda, can no longer rely upon the representations of the operator.
They can rely on them for 4 years, but if they have suspicions, which you clearly would hear. I mean, this lease was nearly a year over. There was only one well that was being drilled or worked on. They had some duty to do something more than to come back in after 20 years, because when you allow a claim after 20 years, it creates the kind of problems you'll see in the Wagner-Vakias half of this case.
There are always problems when you rely on the discovery rule, though. I mean, it extends limitations. I mean, that's the point of it, correct?
It is, but the discovery rule clearly does not apply in this case.
Let me ask, on tab 4, the letter, did I understand you to say that this is accurate? Everything in this,
no statement.
Everything in this letter is accurate?
We believe the record will show that there's no statement in here that is not true. The marshal's complaint is that this is selective, and that had they known more information, it would have put them on notice to make further inquiry. But this court has rejected that notion that fraud includes a duty, once you've said something, to say everything. That's Restatement 551.
Well, the marshals put a little finer point on their argument. Their argument's that the statements in this letter, even if they're all true, provide a picture of this, of what's going on in that oil patch that was not accurate. So even though everything here is true, there's a duty to provide other information, which was that Walker Well number one was a dry hole and was never going to produce.
But that's in here. It's absolutely in this letter that that's a dry hole, and that now Sanchez O'Brien has spudded a well. That's the last sentence, and it turned out eventually to be a producer.
Why shouldn't the court adopt a restatement?
Well, I'm not saying the court should never adopt that restatement. If it's a very simple proposition that one thing was said, and that leaves a demonstrably false impression if you knew one other fact. But this is a very complicated situation. The Court of Appeals spends more than two pages, from 447 to 449 of Southwestern 3rd, explaining what it thinks that BP could have said that would have led the marshals to make further inquiry. And I invite you to read that part of the case very closely, because many of those statements don't mean anything to me, even after thinking fairly hard about this case. And then the court summarized with this statement of the law. The Court of Appeals on page 449 said, the evidence shows that if all the relevant information had been fully and accurately disclosed, the marshals would have been prompted to further investigate. I submit that's an unworkable standard for people who are not in a confidential or fiduciary relationship. And you really, if you read this for guidance, as someone in a commercial enterprise, if you read this case to know how much you should say in answer to an inquiry to someone you're doing business with, you're left with the inevitable conclusion, I should either say nothing at all, or else I'm going to have a jury trial in 10 years and I'll find out.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Phillips.
You.
Ms. Barron.
Please, the court, I'm here for Wagner on the Wagner-Vikias part of this case. It's really a separate appeal. It involves limitations and trespass to try title. The jury found that Wagner had acquired limitations title to the Vikias lease under the 3, 5, and 10-year adverse possession statutes. Court appeals reversed, saying the issue should never have gone to the jury because fraudulent conduct on the part of BP two decades earlier had prevented Vikias from knowing that the lease had terminated. The Court of Appeals decision threatens the settlement and repose of title, and it's wrong for four reasons. First, as this Court has recognized, a record title owner's ignorance of what it owns is not a bar to limitation. It's not what you think you own, it's what you actually own. Second, Wagner repudiated what Vikias actually owned. That Vikias unleashed co-tenants' right to possess the minerals. For 19 years, Wagner claimed the exclusive right to all the minerals and not just a co-tenant share.
How does a bona fide purchaser play into all of this argument here?
Well, I think it bears the fact that it shows that Wagner did not participate in any fraud. The bona fide purchaser finding is contrary to the Court of Appeals finding that fraud somehow affected the running of limitations in this case. These court's decisions on bona fide purchaser make clear that your sole remedy is against the fraudfeasor, which is what we're arguing in our case. But the court doesn't really need to reach the bona fide purchaser because I think this case should be decided on the adverse possession issue. Turning to our other two points, there's no such thing as fraud by privity. Fraudulent concealment by a predecessor does not toll limitations against a successor who has no knowledge of and does not participate in the fraud. And as I just told Justice Medina, it's undisputed here that Wagner did not participate in the fraud. And fourth, there's really no reason to disrupt the settlement and repose of titles by creating a fraud remedy. Vikias had one. It was adequate. They sued the fraudfeasor. They settled. dismiss that claim with prejudice, and they've been made whole. I'm going to focus on repudiation and fraud by privity. Turning to repudiation, it's important to bear in mind, if a co-tenant comes onto the land, drills a well, and says nothing, he's presumed to be there in furtherance of his rightful share. But if a co-tenant comes on the land, drills a well, and says, I get all of it, I have the exclusive right, and you have no right to the proceeds, then that's a repudiation. Here, Wagner didn't come on the property silently. It didn't claim just a co-tenant share. For 19 years, it said, we have the exclusive right to drill, produce, possess the minerals to the exclusion of IKEA. And IKEA knew this. We have a handout, the green sheet called Wagner Chronology, and this highlights some of the affirmative actions that IKEA took that recognized the claim to the lease. And they sort of fall into three categories. First, their actions that recognize the lease. They sued to enforce the lease. They signed division orders ratifying and confirming the lease. And as this court knows, the claim to hold lease is the mineral equivalent of a fence with a locked gate. The lessor has no right to come onto the property to drill, possess, or explore for the minerals. The lessee has the exclusive right to the minerals during the term of the lease. Second, it shows that Wagner tendered and Vikeas accepted royalty every month for 19 years. And Vikeas' expert testified that the checks clearly showed a royalty interest of 4.23% and not a co-tenant share of 25.39% that Vikeas would be entitled to as an unleased co-tenant.
Okay, are you saying that that was explicit on the checks, that that was a royalty interest?
Check certs do give information about production and the percent that's being paid, and their expert testified that the checks did clearly show a royalty interest. Plus, they certified their interest in the division order. They said, our interest in these wells is a royalty interest, and it's 4.2317%. We would assert that the payment of royalty instead of a co-tenant share was an act hostile to their unleased co-tenant interest.
Actually, just a quick question on adverse possession. Do you say it's possible to adversely possess a mineral lease in this
That's
situation?
What this court held in Poole, absolutely.
Well, didn't we make a lot of distinctions in Poole between regular leases and co-tenancies? There's a paragraph that I note on page 194 where we said many times the parties to distinguishing that the parties to the leases here were not co-tenants, there was no co-tenancy, and we emphasized that several times.
Right, and I think that made the court's job a little bit easier in Poole, but Poole applied the exact same repudiation standard. It applied the standard that was announced in Moore versus Knight and Moritz versus Thatcher and Texwith versus Johnson, and that's a repudiation standard that applies both to co-tenants and also to holdovers after tender of a deed or holdovers after expiration of a lease. All require repudiation. And the court in Poole did recognize that if you claim a lease, you are claiming all of the minerals, which is an action hostile to the other interest owner's interest in the property. The court also recognized that paying royalty when they were entitled to the whole thing was also a repudiation. So I'd say the court didn't have, there were some things that were different because it was a co-tenant. For example, a co-tenant can come on the land and drill the well. And if that's all they're doing, that's not a repudiation. But if you're claiming the exclusive right to the minerals, that's a far different case. And that's the case we have here. The third thing this handout shows is that Vikeas filed its own documents in the deed records that recognized it had a royalty interest, that recognized the lease. And it also shows how at the time these were filed, and basically what their documents in the deed records do is they transferred the mineral interest from Vikeas Ranch, the original lessor, to the two partnerships that are the current plaintiffs holders of the mineral interest in this lawsuit. At the time those various deeds were filed, the assignments from Sanchez O'Brien to ARCO, from ARCO to FINA, from FINA to Wagner, were all in the deed records. They all very clearly identified that they were claiming the lease between Vikeas and ARCO. It gave the date. It also gave the deed record sites where the various leases were recorded.
Do you think that there are a lot of other examples of this scenario happening around the state?
I think there will be. And I think the court has seen a number of cases where titles that have been secure for decades or centuries are being challenged based on claims of fraud or bill of review type actions. You saw it in Frost National Bank versus Fernandez, in Curlin versus Sauceda, in King Ranch versus Chapman.
It just seems to me that if you're right, that it would be pretty easy for some company out there to start making royalty payments in a co-tenant situation, if it's however prevalent that may be, just to see what happens. And maybe they get away with it for a while.
Well, I doubt that they can, but I think they would also have to do more. They'd have to claim we own the entire fleet.
And then after a period of years, because of course the royalty owner is getting all this, so-called royalty owner, getting all this payment, things are looking good, and all of a sudden 10 years later, it's, oh, by the way, we own your share of the property now.
Well, I think that goes to, you have to pay attention to your rights. You have to read the check skirt. I don't think that's a difficult thing to require somebody to do when the checks come every month in the mail. Plus, Vakia said, we hired a petroleum engineer every year to review the production records so that we could pay our own taxes. So they were looking at this very closely.
Every mineral owner has to have an expert on call to review all these things when they get a check in the mail.
No, you just have to see what the percentage is on there. And there's a big difference between 4.23 and 25.39%.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument now from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Patton and Mr. Gunn will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Patton will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, Tim Patton for the Marshall family.
May I ask you, is this payment of a royalty a hostile act?
I think under the case law, it is.
And so how do you explain that? How do you deal with that?
I think that's Wagner's main petition, and it's a main point in their petition.
Right.
And based on the numerous cases they cite, it is a signal to the person getting paid royalties. They are not getting paid as a mineral interest owner. They're getting paid as a royalty owner with no right to possess the property.
Exactly.
I'm going to address limitations first, within my time, because that's the point that BP's counsel addressed. Their limitations argument totally ignores the standard review and omits any reference to the evidence supporting the jury's finding that the marshals could not, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, have discovered the lease termination of the fraud until June of 2000. Not mentioned in their brief or addressed today, there was testimony from two experts, only one of whom was employed by the marshals, that the marshals, not just the marshals, but a specialized oil and gas expert, could not have discovered the lease termination of the fraud till June of 2000, when BP produced confidential documents in discovery. These are documents that are stamped in big letters, confidential, and it was only when an expert was able to look at those documents and then compare them to matters on file with the Railroad Commission that he could determine that the lease had in fact terminated and that BP had fraudulently concealed the termination of that lease.
Well, do the marshals or any other party similarly situated have a duty to do more than what your client did, perhaps go to the Railroad Commission, perhaps have further inquiry?
Well, had they gone to the Railroad Commission, there was nothing on file with the Railroad Commission that would have alerted them to the lease termination of the fraud, because again, it was only until 2000 when an expert was able to compare confidential BP documents against the Railroad Commission filings that anyone was able to determine that the lease had terminated. Also,
those two experts, Graham and Masichik, am I pronouncing that right?
No, that's a different expert on liability and damages. It's a Wagner expert.
Who is the other expert then?
It's a Wagner expert. I don't remember his name. It's in our brief. But the Wagner expert likewise testified that even an expert couldn't have known about the lease termination until 2000.
BP says the June letter tells them that Walker Well number one was dead.
Well, an interesting point about that letter in terms of the evidence not mentioned in their brief, there is testimony from a BP expert, which is cited and quoted in our brief, where the BP expert testified that there was nothing in that letter that would have alerted the marshals to the lease having terminated. BP's own expert said that the marshals were entitled to take that letter at face value. The idea, the premise, that this is just another lawsuit where a royalty owner has slept on his or her rights for 20 years is fundamentally flawed. This is not a case where a royalty owner sued. This is a case where a mineral interest owner sued. In 1981, the marshals asked BP about the status of their lease. BP lied to them in 1981, and then BP was off the lease in 1981. BP is out of the picture.
Well, counsel, BP lied to them exactly how?
I think a half-truth is a lie.
Okay, so your position is the letter. Is there anything other than the letter?
Yes, I think that in the phone call, as the Court of Appeals recognized, that the statement that Mr. Young made to Stanley Marshall that there was no cessation of operations for a 60-day period, I think that's a factual misrepresentation.
Okay, so that phone conversation, is as it is in the record, and this letter then is the lie.
Oh, I think the phone conversation is also a lie.
That's what I said. The phone conversation and the letter is the lie.
Yes.
Anything else?
No, I think that's it. I think we rest our fraud case on the phone conversation and the letter.
And that's what the jury based their decision on?
Yes. It's a broad form fraud submission, which includes both affirmative misrepresentations and representations by basically half-truth.
And so you said half-truth. So is your position that the court should adopt a restatement?
I think the court should, but I don't think it necessarily needs to adopt the entire restatement. I think if this court, as we say in our brief, doesn't adopt at least the principle that a half-truth, a statement that is intentionally misleading because it leaves out critical information and it's intended to give a false impression, I think this would be the only state in the union where half-truths are not actionable. And whether you call it adopting Section 551 or not, absolutely the law should be that intentional half-truths that are designed to mislead somebody should be actionable fraud.
It's just hard to see how that works in the real world, because I was just thinking of like a building contract, and the owner doesn't go out, doesn't watch the contract, the building being built. He just waits till the end of it, and then he goes out and asks the contractor, did you build this according to the plans? And the contractor said, yes, I think I did. And then 10 years later, 20 years later, he discovers that something was left out or something was wrong or something was not done according to the plans, and he sues for fraud. It just seems like it turns everything into fraud.
Well, I think the hypothetical you just gave is a little different because it's more of a contort type of
why? Because it seems to me you're asking the same thing. Were you always trying to get production out of this well? Well, you know, there's a lawsuit about that, and reasonable minds can differ, and you go back and forth, and maybe a jury is going to ultimately answer it. But it just seems to me like if you say to somebody, are you in the right and not in the wrong, he's going to answer, yes, I'm in the right. And how's that fraudulent?
That might not be, but that is a world of difference between sending somebody a three-page letter where you itemize 40 separate dates, and in those 40 separate dates, much of the time you leave out critical information, which had you provided that information, you would have alerted the recipient of that letter to a problem.
Itemize that critical information left out.
Among the information is that as of September 22, 1980, BP, then ARCO, had completely given up on the lower Wilcox. They had the only level, the only area in which they thought there was any production. Their entire budget was devoted to the lower Wilcox. There was nothing there.
As of September 1980?
September 22, 1980. doing it from memory.
Didn't the primary term of the lease end in July 1980?
Yes. Lease would have terminated on July 12th. So on September 22, they reached the total depth, Lower Wilcox, and there's nothing there. The entire budget, that was their really only objective. They know the reason they drilled the well was not there.
So it was within the 60 days?
Yes. So then they go back up to the Middle Wilcox to investigate a show. And as of December 22nd, they conclude there's nothing there. Their own documents conclude as of December 22nd, there's nothing in the Middle Wilcox.
What's your position on this future accounting award?
I'm not sure whether I should finish answering that question or go to...
I thought you finished Justice Wainwright's
question. So the next critical date is December 22nd, and then the next critical date is January 16, where that's the Blood Oath memo where BP says, we're giving up on the well. There's nothing here. We don't want to spend any more money. And they said, well, we got to do something. So let's keep reworking the well, which is not good faith operations, which they do for months. So by either September 22nd, December 22, but certainly by January 16, they're done with any remotely good faith operation.
Don't you also argue that reworking a well is not sufficient to extend the lease? It has to be producing in commercial quantities?
All the experts agreed, including BP's experts, and the jury was instructed that it needs to be more than reworking. It needs to be the actions of a reasonably prudent operator acting in good faith with efforts designed to produce gas in paying quantities, which there was nothing BP did after December 28th that was designed to produce gas in paying quantities.
Could you please address Justice Medina's question about the accounting?
I would like to, because I suspect that's the main reason we're here. I'm a little concerned. I just want to point out that I don't want to step on Mr. Gunn's time, but I'm happy to do it. So I'm hoping you'll give him more time, because we're not aligned.
You're taking a lot of time up just working for Mr. Gunn.
I'm trying to be nice here.
Yeah, what's the answer to perpetuity on that?
Very briefly, I think the future accounting is appropriate under the very cases cited in BP's brief and in the brief filed by the Texas Oil and Gas Association. Those cases recognize that when a case is so complex that an adequate legal remedy cannot be fashioned, it's appropriate to utilize the equitable remedy of accounting. And here we have uncontroverted testimony from an expert witness who said because there were so many variables existing at the time of trial, for example, we don't know how many wells are going to be drilled on the lease. We don't know whether they're going to be productive. We don't know what the price of gas is. We cannot accurately predict the future damages of the marshals.
And is BP in a position to be able to do that now?
What this case raises the question of is, if you commit fraud and you indisputably cause somebody future damages, do you get off the hook for those future damages, because it's going to be difficult from an accounting perspective to calculate those damages?
Difficult, or tell me how that's going to happen.
BP, I think, exaggerates how difficult it's going to be. As a practical matter, the production records from every well, the sales records from every well are available. The only difficult area will be the expenses required to generate the production. So again, BP's position is that because they don't have access to those records, they get to walk away from all the damages caused by the fraud. And the trial court exercises its discretion to say, no, BP, you don't get to walk away from the damages you caused by the fraud. We're going to make you account for it. And there's a number of ways you could have them account. You could appoint a master. You could appoint an auditor. But again, the question before this court is, do you let someone walk away from future damages they indisputably caused?
What effect does that have on Wagner?
On Wagner?
Mm-hmm.
On the Wagner appeal, I don't think it has any effect. We actually agree with the Wagners that they acquired the title by adverse possession. We lost it by adverse possession, and our remedy is against BP. Mm-hmm. But the future accounting remedy is really not involved in the Wagner-Vakias appeal.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Patton. Mr. Gunn.
Thank you.
To make BP's third point, at three levels of court, BP and I have been arguing that these two appeals, these two cases, give you one choice between two worlds, and you've got to choose. What's the right remedy for fraud? Is it a property rules remedy, or is it a punitive damage remedy? It's like we heard the word contort. We're dealing with prop tort here. Property or tort? Because in Wagner's world,
fraud is not challenged.
Fraudulent concealment's not challenged. It's a question of what's the remedy. And if you squeeze one end of the toothpaste tube and say, well, it can't be title, then it must be damages, which is, that's where the marshals and our people diverged about the remedy. They wanted to swing at the pinata for punitive damages. They didn't get it, but that was the goal. We say that's not what's going on at all. BP and I say adverse possession doesn't work that way. It's not a tort. It is a theory with two elements, and I ask you to write your opinion very simply and dispose of this case on this one ground, the whole thing, all four parties. You should say adverse possession has two elements. There's the adversity part, the ouster part, and there's a clock part, accrual. It's not challenged that fraudulent concealment stops the clock. Wagner doesn't challenge it. They don't challenge that there was fraudulent concealment. Ergo, the clock stopped. Nobody lost title because of the underlying actions. There was no adverse possession against us. There was no adverse possession against the marshals, and the case is over.
So how does your swinging pinata come into this? I didn't catch that.
The punitive damages. The marshals made a tactical choice to take a swing for punitive damages and ask the jury. That we didn't see that coming. As we were going through this case, we thought this was just a title case. But late in the day, at the close of the evidence, they wanted to tee up a punitive damage question, and they got it. And at that point, two roads diverged in the woods, and we just said, we just want our property back. That's all we want. They wanted punitive. Now, the jury didn't award it, but that's what they wanted, and that's the flood that's going to come if you adopt the world that Wagner and the marshals are trying to foist on you. You're going to see punitive damages asked for, tort damages in all of these cases. And I say that don't go for that flood. You notice that they don't stop the flood. They just reroute it and say, well, we don't want it to be a title remedy. We want it to be a damage remedy and you know, go sue for damages. I say don't go there. I agree with BP. It cuts off causation in the BP case. It cuts off loss of title in our case.
It seems to me there are two problems, though, with your position. I'm not sure the fraud rule would work generally, but maybe it does. But Wagner did not commit the fraud.
Right.
So why should they bear the burden of that?
Because they stand in the shoes of the fraud feeder. Like a bank robber's got a bag of money, and he hires a contractor and said, here, will you carry this to the hotel for me, and I'll pay you. That's all that happened when...
Generally, a BFP doesn't.
Oh, but they're not a BFP.
Well, there's an argument about that.
Well, there should be no argument whatsoever for two reasons. It is wrong factually, and it's irrelevant legally. Factually, it is wrong. Look at the deeds. Look at the assignments. They are quitclaims. Read Tom Phillips' opinion for the court in Rogers versus Rycane from 1990 and lay the words of it next to the words of these assignments. The assignments all down the chain, these are quitclaim deeds. You can't be a BFP in a quitclaim. But more than that, it is irrelevant because think about, you got to go back to the bundle of sticks. You're splitting the real property bundle of fee simple into two completely different sticks. The company side has got this leasehold stick. They're a BFP of that. But if you ask the question, BFP of what, that answers it. Those of us, the marshals and I, are on this side. We've got the possibility of reverter. We didn't sell anything to Wagner or anyone else. Our possibility of reverter ripens into fee simple title, period. The bona fide purchaser status does not change the nature of the asset. It cuts off the right to rescind a voidable sale. But we don't have a sale between us and the other side. It's just automatic. It happens. So BFP goes absolutely nowhere. Now, there is this equitable pull to it, and I acknowledge that. because, frankly, it gives me some discomfort. It's kind of like musical chairs. Wagner and I are not really guilty of much, and when the music stops, there's only one chair, and it's got to go to somebody. But that's why you just stick with traditional property rights rules, just the privity of estate rule. Remember, they wanted privity of estate for tacking purposes, because they said, well, we stand in the shoes of our predecessor, and they're in the shoes of their predecessor. It tacks all the way back, and if I could stress this, because I didn't stress it in the brief, look at the farm-out agreement, the contract and the relationship between ARCO and the first step down the title chain, which was Sanchez O'Brien. That farm-out agreement, it's just a contract. It says, this is the bank robber hypo I was talking about. It says, if you will come in as a contractor and drill, if you'll go do something, I will assign you my interest, what I have. And they did. They quit-claimed it to them. Well, they're no better off. Sanchez O'Brien is no better off than their predecessor in title. That they step into the shoes. If the shoes are clean, they get clean shoes. If the shoes are dirty, they get dirty shoes. You take the better with the sweet.
You agree that the adversity part of the problem is the same as pool, that the co-tenancy really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you have to apply an ouster standard for co-tenancy, but I absolutely agree.
Because if you're getting a check for a sixth of what you're supposed to get, that's adverse.
It can be. And I'm willing to, for purposes of today, I don't need the adverse ouster side of the case to win. It is more controversial, and I think without the fraud, without the context of our eyes being clouded by fraud, we would have a big problem sustaining our position there. I think it really comes down to the fraud. But we don't need that. The accrual argument is a one-issue ruling that ends this entire case for both sides. And if I could close by just talking about Poole one second. Poole is controversial in oil and gas circles in the royalty owner camp. I'm proud of Poole. I stood here 8.5 years ago asking you, on the day that Poole was argued, I was in the companion case, asking you to adopt the rule that you adopted in Poole. I think it is sound, and you should stand on it. You should embrace it. I think it applies, and it stopped the flood. There's been no more flood. There was a problem of people going out trying to bust leases. Poole put an end to that. But that's all about lease termination. That's not about fraud. What we have here between me and the Wagner folks is we have unchallenged findings of fraud. They haven't attacked any fact-finding, nothing in the verdict. We're just here saying, Your Honors, we're serving you a plate of undisputed facts. What's the legal effect? And I'm asking you, make the legal ruling. If there's fraud, there's got to be a remedy. Do we want it to be a damage remedy, or can we use the traditional property rights remedy? I say use the latter. If the court has no further questions, I'm done.
Seems they don't. Thank you, Mr. Gunn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court will hear rebuttal.
May it please the court. First, I would like to respond to Mr. Patton's argument that there was a fact question on whether or not, as a matter of law, you could tell from the public records back within 4 years back before limitations ran, that BP predecessor ARCO was not acting as a reasonably prudent operator. We believe clearly in the records there is. The plaintiff's expert said that any prudent operator examining the log on the Upper Wilcox would have known in August of 1980, well, they were still drilling at the Lower Wilcox, before they started drilling, that the Upper Wilcox would not produce in paying quantities. He also said, a reasonable and prudent operator looking at the log for the Upper Wilcox would come to only one possible conclusion, and that was that the Upper Wilcox was going to be a dud. That log was in the Railroad Commission files in plenty of time in Austin, taken with the Railroad Commission plugging report in Corpus Christi. You could tell on the public records that as of August 1980, their expert said he would have been on notice that this was not a reasonably prudent operator. The evidence that Mr. Patton refers to in the record about, well, we had to get BP's internal files to know that there was a claim here. If you look at all those questions, they talk about good faith. Now, our standard's kind of multifaceted. It's a long standard, reasonably prudent operator acting in good faith to produce commercially payable quantities. But it's an objective standard. And the questions that Mr. Patton says raise a fact issue about what the marshals could have known back in the early 80s. Those are asking about good faith in a subjective way. What was in BP's mind? From the log records and the plugging report, could you tell what BP was thinking back in 1980? Well, probably not. But could you tell they were that, in your view of the case, they weren't acting as a reasonably prudent operator? Yes, you could tell that.
The jury found to the contrary, right?
And we say there's no evidence.
The marshals claim you haven't attacked that jury finding. You haven't.
Well, that's just wrong. I mean, we attacked the finding by numbers, and we talked about no evidence that would toll limitations all the briefs.
I'm sorry, counsel. What do you mean you attacked the finding by numbers?
We said there's no evidence to support findings number 5 and 7. That's in the appellant's brief in the Court of Appeals. And throughout our briefing, we talk about there's no evidence that they were acting in a reasonable way, with reasonable prudence, so as to toll limitations, which is an attack on that finding.
Did you address this future accounting award? I remember that was one of your 4 points. I don't remember you speaking.
Yes. First of all, we don't believe you get there, because we believe that this is a co-tenant payment case and not a fraud damages case, and that the marshals made a strategic decision, as Mr. Gunn was discussing, they made a strategic decision to settle with the producers for either nothing, or either give up against them or settle for less than the payments they were due, and then try to get the balance of their damages in an actual damage award. And they then went and asked for $120 million punitive damage award. Well, it broke down when the jury gave nothing in punitive damages. But even if you got there and said there were some damages for any reason against BP, the accounting is just, it can't be the right way to go, because BP is not operating anything. It never produced a drop of oil or a cubic centimeter of gas. An accounting remedy is not damages. It's asking somebody to give an account of what they received, and BP received nothing.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Ms. Barron, you have 3 minutes.
Bakia says there's a choice between damages and title, and they made that choice, and they recovered damages from the fraud abuser in this case, so they have made their choice. They say the clock stopped because of fraudulent concealment, but they obtained findings on fraudulent concealment only on the part of BP. You also have to look at, what are we timing with this clock? And if you look at the statute, it's not their fraud claim against BP that we're timing. If you read the adverse possession statutes, they say an action to recover land held in peaceful and adverse possession by another. So it's a trespass to try title claim is what we're looking at. They obtained no findings of fraudulent concealment on the trespass to try title claim. And in terms of when does your trespass to try title claim occur, this court answered that dispositively 150 years ago in Horton versus Crawford. It actually asked the question, when does the cause of action accrue? And the court said unquestionably at the moment of possession under the circumstances set forth in the statute. What they're saying is
there's no evidence that anything's different as to the Bakias rather than the marshals, is it?
No.
And if the marshals didn't know, the Bakias didn't know.
Exactly. Yes. They say we didn't challenge fraud findings. Those are findings of fraud and fraudulent concealment by BP, not by Wagner. They say we stepped into their shoes in privity. We did not tack with them. You can't tack with somebody. The only way you can adversely possess minerals is to go out there, drill a well, and start producing. And ARCO and BP never did that. Finally, these aren't quick claim deeds. If you look at them, they're not a cut and run of whatever we own. You have to look and see whether they transfer title or whether they just say, I give you whatever I've got. They identify the leases. They identify by block number, division number, grant number. They have plats. They have meets and bounds. They reserve certain rights to various parties, and they have continuing obligations. It's not a cut and run quick claim deed. And just fraudulent concealment just is not imputed to innocent third parties. We cited the court. recognized that only if you participate in or have knowledge of a fraud can your a cause of action against you be told. It's an estoppel issue where the fraud feeder can't take advantage of his own fraud to prevent to insert limitations into the case. It's a particularly dangerous concept when you get into land titles. What they're saying is hidden fraud decades ago, centuries ago, stops the clock forever. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to see more lawsuits seeking to divest title that's been settled for decades and even centuries. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.